can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome back to another episode of More Than Ordinary, brought to you by Seven Generation Games. I'm Anne-Marie DeMars.
And I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And joining us here today, we have...
Kelly Cunningham.
Kelly, you will soon know, is the producer of 18th and Grand, a documentary on the Olympic Auditorium and Eileen Eaton, which we'll talk about shortly. She also grew up in New Hampshire. So contrary to popular belief, it turns out there were black people in New Hampshire.
Yes, there are.
Not anymore. The one person moved away. You were telling us about the history of New Hampshire?
Yeah. Contrary to popular belief, there are black people in New Hampshire, and we have been there since before this country was a country. The town of New Market, New Hampshire, famous for shipbuilding, and even some people say started the Revolutionary War, was founded by a black man, a black freedman who was a shipbuilder, and his son ended up building John Paul Jones's house and a lot of the houses in historical Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
So obviously you are a history geek, which led you to what you're doing now. So earlier, before we were recording, you were telling me about Eileen Eaton and how fascinating she was. And some people may not know this, but Eileen Eaton, if you listen to our last podcast, is Jean LaBelle's mother. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about the facts that will be in your documentary?
Well, 18th and Grand is essentially about the Olympic Auditorium, but the Olympic Auditorium wouldn't be anything without Eileen Eaton. Eileen Eaton is a very, very complex and complicated and ambitious woman, you know, who's, you know, very good at business, kind of terrible at motherhood. And her life was like a big old nighttime soap opera. She's so interesting.
And can you tell us a little bit how you started to learn about her, how you, you know, came to know about her and what led to you wanting to do the documentary?
I came to know Eileen Eaton through Jean LaBelle, who's her son. And I had been working with Jean LaBelle for close to maybe 12 years. And he would talk about his mother and his time at the Olympic, but I would sit with him and ask him more and more things about his mother and his childhood, because he had some really messed up things happen to him in his childhood, at which he thought were very, you know, normal. And I'm like, no, that's not normal. And he'd always say, well, my mother was working. And I was like, well, what was she doing? And I found out, yeah, she was running a boxing venue. She was a boxing promoter. She was doing all these things in the 40s that women just didn't do.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. I mean, talking about giving it a little more context. Obviously, a woman boxing promoter, but we're talking about an age where women were hardly working, let alone serving as boxing promoters.
I would say she was very ambitious from the very start, because when she came to this country, she came to this country as a teenager from Canada. And the first thing she wanted to do, she wanted to go to law school like her older brother. And at that time, this is the late 1920s, girls didn't really do that. But she wanted to anyway, and she wanted to follow in her brother's footsteps. And her brother, you know, he was very young, and he went to law school, and he passed the bar at a very young age, so she wanted to do that too. But at the same time, she ended up getting married, and when she married, she did something that I call beta testing with her first husband, Maurice LaBelle. She wanted to make him into something. This was a guy who was just happy to just be a student, happy to be a musician, plays guitar. She was like, no, I'm going to make you a star. I'm going to make you into something. So she crafted him into this thing called the Diet Doctor to the Stars and promoted him as such and got him into Hollywood so all the starlets would come to him and come to his clinic, his reducing clinic, and they would have classes and luncheons and all that other stuff. And she promoted him so much that, you know, people in Hollywood got to know them and got to know them as a couple, and they actually made a movie about their relationship and their eventual breakup. And it starred Cary Grant. It was called Kiss and Make Up, and it was made in 1935. And Cary Grant plays this, you know, doctor to the stars, and his character's name was Maurice LaMarre instead of Maurice LaBelle. And so she beta tested with him, but she couldn't quite get it right because she wanted someone that she could mold so she could be the power behind this great creation, and she could take credit for this great creation. Didn't quite work out with Maurice. They ended up getting divorced, which is a whole other big story.
Well, I want to hear that big story because you said that she never told her kids that she got divorced.
No, she never did, because divorce was still kind of a taboo thing at that time. Jean was born in 1932. Their marriage sort of went awry around 35, 36. And they were actually divorced, or fully divorced, I believe, 1939. And that wasn't a thing that anybody really did, because it was scandalous. And, you know, she couldn't deal with him. And he, talking to relatives and such who still remember them, he was very broken up because he was a very happy-go-lucky guy. You know, he didn't really want to have a care in the world or anything like that. And she was like, no, you're not doing it for me. You're not good enough. You know, the beta test has failed. I need to start from scratch. And so they divorced. And but she didn't tell her two kids that they were divorced. Instead, she shipped them off to military school so she could go off and work. So they went to boarding school, this boarding military school, and they had no clue that their parents lived separate lives or anything.
And how old were they then?
Let's see. Jean was 5. So I believe this was 1937, 38, I think. He started military boarding school when he was 5, and then he was kicked out when he was 7.
So this was a live-in school.
Right? Yes.
Oh my God. See, I find that crazy because when my youngest daughter went off to boarding school, she was going into the 9th grade and she was 13. And my husband and I were still like, oh my God, my baby. Yeah. Can you imagine? You send Amelia to boarding school, Maria?
No, not going to happen. I'm lucky I can get her to a regular school and be away from me for 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day, whatever it is.
Now, tell me about Gene living by himself and the housekeeper, because you were telling me that earlier.
Oh, goodness. This is goes again in the file under bad mothering. After Gene was summarily kicked out of military school for beating up other kids, he had to go and you know, basically live on his own because his mother by that time had met Cal Eaton, who was a boxing promoter. And again, this is 1942-43, right after the war had started. And Cal Eaton, he's not a nice guy. He's not of a, he doesn't have a very good reputation. His family doesn't have a very, very, very good reputation. It seems like they're a, you know, a strange group of grifters because Cal was still married to someone else at that time when Eileen decided to move in with him because she realized that she could get more power and more respect working at the Olympic Auditorium if she was with Cal. But Cal was kind of not really doing anything because he was a functional alcoholic and he was just the worst. So she left. Cal took a liking to Jean's older brother, Mike, and he lived with them while Jean was left in Eileen's old residence on Fuller Street in Hollywood. And Jean was 10 at the time when Eileen went and moved in with Cal. And he lived there alone until Mike, I think, got out of college. And Mike married, and he and his wife moved in the house and then told Gene he had to live in the garage, and Gene lived in the garage later on in his teenage years. But while he, you know, growing up as a little kid, Gene was pretty much, you know, self-sufficient, with the exception of having a housekeeper that would come in and she would, you know, cook, clean, you know, do laundry and stuff like that. And, you know, Gene would only see his mother maybe once a week or so. And,
yeah, no. So this, as I'm listening to this, I'm wondering, what was it that drew you to doing a story about her? Because up to this point, she sounds like a really horrible person.
The things she did when she was at the Olympic, her mothering, her parenting is just, she is a horrible person. But when you get her in that Olympic auditorium, she turned into a superstar. She was a star promoter, and she did amazing things. She ran, you know, LA's most notorious gangster, Mickey Cohen. She threw him out of the Olympic by his arm. But she said, get out. You know, I don't want you here or anything like that. She single-handedly took over, basically took over the fight game in Los Angeles and basically the West Coast by outsmarting two guys who were deep into the mob, who ended up getting investigated by the FBI and the state and having their licenses revoked, their promotion licenses revoked. She even threw her own husband under the bus in order to take control of this place and all the fight game on the West Coast.
It's maybe a funny analogy, but it kind of makes me reminds me of things like The Art of War, where, or The Prince by Machiavelli, where you've got these people who are really horrible people, but they are kind of brilliant at using every trick that you can think of to accomplish something, to consolidate a huge amount of power. So that's admirable in a kind of creepy way.
Very much so. I think so. Even like with her husband, throwing her husband under the bus, I think it's my own theory. I don't know for sure whether or not she did this by design when she went after her second husband, Cal, and ended up marrying him, because he was awful to begin with. He was married to someone else, had abandoned a wife and child when he was a teenager, and was still married to them, and but then only divorced after he set up an arranged marriage of his son, who he didn't see for 15 years, to the governor's daughter. And so then the son became in his life or whatever. But other than that, no. But she knew he was useless. She knew that he just had a name. And she knew she could use it, and she knew he would not get in her way simply because he was a functional alcoholic. He was a womanizer, and she didn't really care. Like, when they got married, they did not sleep in the same bed. They had separate bedrooms, but that was good enough for her. If he was going to go, you know, bang his girlfriend who worked at iMagnon, he was going to do that. She had work to do. She had business to take care of. She had money to make.
When you say she threw her husband under the bus, was it a literal thing? Because I can kind of envision that as you've told the story. Or what do you mean by threw her husband under the bus?
In 1954, the FBI started a huge investigation in boxing and wrestling because a lot of mobsters were involved in fixing fights. And one of the big controversies, or one of the big turning points, were the fights fixed by a boxing promoter named Babe McCoy. And he had very strong ties to the mob. He had very strong ties to Frankie Carbo, who basically, he's the guy responsible for killing Bugsy Siegel. You know, and it was getting really, really dirty. And at the time, the governor was married to Cal Eaton's, the governor's daughter was married to Cal Eaton's son. And so the governor, you know, during the FBI investigation, Cal would always try to use his connections to make the investigations go away, to keep the scrutiny off of him. But it wasn't working this time. because now that the feds were involved, the governor of California was like, I cannot be associated with you anymore. And the state athletic commission decided to hold hearings and an investigation on whether or not all these fights were fixed. There were gambling and racketeering and stuff going on. And Eileen was called in to testify. And in a way, I guess she used her feminine charms or just, you know, played, oh, I'm a little woman, and went in there and testified, said, oh, I don't know anything, when she knew everything that was going on, and basically delivered Babe McCoy, her husband, and a couple other guys on a silver platter, basically saying, oh, they did these things without my knowledge. I'm sorry. I didn't know. If they had done it, then I wouldn't have done business with them, when she knew all along what was going on, but she just threw her husband and his partners under the bus.
I'm shocked, shocked to find gambling is going on in this establishment. If you young people haven't watched Casablanca, you should.
Hey, Jonah, you know what I love? Seven Generation Games.
I know, they're the best. I got them for all my nieces and nephews. They teach math and social studies. They love the games.
I wanted to get them for my niece in third grade, but she only has an iPad. I just wish they had an app.
But they do.
What?
Yes, Making Camp. It's the first app from Seven Generation Games, and it's out now in the Apple App Store.
So it will just be in the App Store?
Yes. All you'll have to do is search for Making Camp, or you can go to the 7 Generation Games site right now and enter your email to be notified as soon as the Android app is live.
Wow, that's awesome. And they will still sell the other games too, right?
Yep, you can still get Spirit Lake, Fish Lake, and Forgotten Trail just by going to 7generationgames.com/buy to get them today.
Hi, welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by 7 Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars, and we still have with us here our guest,
Kelly Cunningham.
So, Kelly, you were talking earlier about how you're producing the documentary 18th and Grand, but for a lot of people who have heard the term producer but don't actually know what a producer does, what does a producer do?
In a nutshell, a producer is a miracle worker, because sometimes we're asked to do the impossible and make it happen and make it a reality. But in all seriousness, being a producer is part being creative and part being able to figure out logistics, being able to put the right people and the right things together at the right time, being a numbers person, being able to do math, being able to get along with people, being an armchair psychologist to make sure your team, you know, works. If it were a football team, yes, the director would be the quarterback, but the producer, I would say, would be more like the offensive coordinator, you know, the person who puts together the plays and the plans and stuff like that. Yes, the director and the quarterback get all the glory, but they always need a team behind them to make them look good.
Okay, so if I say, well, I'm creative, I want to sit around a room and say, oh, you, go over there and do that. So what specifically do you do? Do you, like, put together the schedule? Do you hire people? Do you put together the budget? Do you do a strategic plan that you pitch to investors? What?
Basically all of that. All of that happens if you need something done or whatever, and you find people that can do the job for you. You know, you have to know how to make a budget and to work within that budget, or sometimes finagle that budget in such a way where you can get a dollar out of 15 cents, you know, or other times you have to pay peacemaker between different factions that may not be getting along or anything like that, be referee for them, but make sure everything runs on time, runs smoothly, and gets put together and looks like something that's recognizable.
And so how do you get to be a producer? Do you just walk in and say, hi, I want to be a producer? Or is it something where you have to, like, work up, you know, your way through Hollywood? What's the role to be? What's the route to being a producer, especially for people who say, I think that's something I'd like to do?
Well, there's two ways. One is, you know, rather unscrupulous, but, you know, some people like having titles. And some people will buy the title of producer. Like, if someone invests or puts enough money to a project or whatever, they can say they were a producer, they produced it, even though they may not have really done anything. There's a really neat Superman story about someone who did that. And later on the DVDs, when the director and the creatives are doing the commentary, this name comes up as producer, single title, and people are like, I don't know who this is.
Hey, that's a great idea for fundraising. Maybe we should do that. If you would like to be a producer for Seven Generation Games, let's see. Fish Lake's coming out, a really, really cool update. If you want to invest tons of money, we'd put you on there as producer. I don't know. What do you say, Maria?
I'm all for it.
Tons of money.
But usually the way someone becomes a producer is basically through relationships. Through relationships in which people that you've worked with or other creatives or people, business people, actually have faith in you and say, you know what, you're smart, or you can do this, or you're really handy, or you're clever, you know, how would you like to oversee this project for me? That's usually how one becomes a producer, when someone sees that you have the ability to actually do all these things that a producer has to do. That's usually how one becomes a producer, and or they create something. That's the biggest way. You know, you create something on your own and it's good. Someone sees it or whatever. Guess what? You have produced something.
Speaking of making things, Making Camp is now available on the App Store. And if you don't have iPads and you're a teacher, guess what? It's available for Chromebook as well. So go to appstore.com/makingcampfree and you can find it. Search for Making Camp for the iPad or email us info@sevengenerationgames.com. And we'd be more than happy to tell you how something that is super fun and educational and documented to increase kids' math scores can be your very own.
And we're back with More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Marie Burns-Ortiz.
I'm Anne-Marie DeMars. We still have with us
Kelly Cunningham.
And this is the tip part of our segment. Anne-Marie really loves to give people unsolicited advice.
But this time, it's Kelly's turn. So, Kelly, do you have a tip that you would like to give to our listeners?
I don't know if it's so much a tip, but more dating advice. Always date someone that you can learn from, because if you're not, you're wasting your time, really.
We were talking about that earlier, and I actually had a friend who was a foreign language instructor. She taught French, Spanish, and Italian, and she said the best way to learn a language was to sleep with it. So I'm not necessarily recommending this plan for our listeners at home, but she said that, you know, she went to France and had a French guy that she hooked up with for several months and learned to speak French, and that's how she learned Italian and Spanish. So is that what you had in mind?
Sort of. I find, you know, forging relationships with people that you can learn from is a way to add skills to your toolbox. I mean, for example, I dated a guy who used to take apart computers, and now I can replace my own backlight in my laptop if I needed to. Or I know how to change oil and filters in a car. So, you know, those things come in handy, and those skills have lasted me longer than any of those relationships have.
That way, if it doesn't work out, at least it wasn't a complete lost cause.
Exactly.
Right. Like, I dated this guy once, and he was kind of a gourmet, and the only thing I got out of the relationship is he said, if you go to a Mexican restaurant, order la especialidad de la casa, because it's always the best, whatever their specialty is, and I have found that to be very true. So that was good advice. He, on the other hand, eh.
And I never dated anyone until I met my husband, so, I mean.
Maria's husband listens to this podcast. Well, you know, Maria, that kind of reminds me of something we did on our YouTube channel. We have a Seven Generation Games YouTube channel, and Maria and I did a 7 Ways to Get Fired at Seven Generation Games. And I think our next one will be 7 Things Not to Say in a Job Application. And we have had people submit things like, look at my YouTube playlist. So yours could be, look at all these guys I dated. See the skills I have.
That would actually make me look at whatever the skills were on the resume.
Well, see, there you go.
But I probably still wouldn't hire that person. I would just use them as fodder for my next YouTube video.
And so you should go over to our YouTube video at Seven Generation Games. We will put everything in the comments on our website. So if you're just downloading this from iTunes, which is cool. I mean, we like our subscribers. You can always go over to sevengenerationgames.com/podcast and see the list of all our podcasts and see comments on it. You can like us on iTunes. You can download Making Camp. You know you want to be smarter.
You can just send us checks in the mail, just because.
And now, for the end of our tip section and the end of today's podcast, Kelly will sing.
The sun will come out tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7GenerationGames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, GenerationGames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7GenerationGames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.